Isaiah chapter 14, verse 24, through chapter 16, verse 14, the 13th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on October 21, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at the last part of Isaiah chapter 14, and then we'll do chapters 15 and 16. The first 12 chapters of Isaiah are introductory in nature, and we've talked about those. But then in chapter 13, it starts a different section, and it's a section of oracles, and it's oracles that are proclaimed concerning the surrounding kingdoms, the neighbors of Israel. And we've looked at the first one, which was spoken to Babylon, and now we're going to get tonight. We'll look at two more of these oracles. This section, starting in verse 24 of chapter 14, in the earlier part of chapter 14 and in 13, it was talking about Babylon. But here in 24 and following, it switches and talks about Assyria. And the question is, how do those fit together? What's going on here? And this section of 10 chapters is broken up by the proclamation, "This is the oracle concerning." And there are about, I think there are 9 of them. And we have another oracle in verse 28, where it says, "In the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came," and this was proclaimed with respect to Philistia. So, relying on those proclamations of the different oracles as being the organizational principle for this 10-chapter section, I think that verses 24 through 27 go with the preceding section, that is, the section regarding Babylon. And as I'm putting it together at this point, the first oracle, which is proclaimed with respect to Babylon, I think is intended to be introductory to all of these oracles, and Babylon is the biggest and baddest of the oppressors. And it talks about what fate Babylon will experience. Then it's going to go on to the other neighbors. So I think what's happening here in 24 when he talks about Assyria is Exhibit A with respect to Babylon. It's an example with respect to Babylon. It's talking about what's going to happen to Assyria, which I think from the perspective of Israel would be almost the same. They're thinking in their minds, the Assyrians are essentially the same people as the Babylonians. And I was trying to think of an example. My guess is that the relationship between the Assyrians and the Babylonians with respect to Israel would be kind of like the relationship between the Dutch and the English to the South Africans. It may be a different country, but they look and act a lot the same. They're basically the same group. And I suspect that that's what's going on here, that Assyria may be a different country from Babylon, but from as far away as Israel, they're virtually indistinguishable. And Assyria seems to be treated here as kind of a subset of Babylon. So I think that's what's going on here. Let me read it, and then we'll talk about what it says. "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, 'Surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so it will stand, to break Assyria in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? So Isaiah is reassuring the people of Israel, people of Judah, that God has his plan. God has laid out human history. And God knows where things are headed. He knows what he's going to accomplish in human history. And those things that he intended to accomplish in human history are all going to be accomplished. And in particular, he's going to talk about later, both he has talked about and will talk more about what will happen with respect to those who have oppressed Israel. And Babylon would be first foremost among those. Assyria would also be among those. So it will happen. That is not in doubt. And he goes on to talk about Assyria in particular, that God will break Assyria in his hand, in his land, and he will trample him on his mountains. I think here what's being pronounced is a prophecy with respect to Assyria that would happen not long after Isaiah would have concluded his professorial ministry. Historically, what happens, and we can read about this, we will come across this later in Isaiah because there's an account of it. Assyria attacks Israel, attacks Judah, and comes to the outskirts of Jerusalem, begins to besiege Jerusalem, and overnight, in the middle of this siege, overnight, there are over 100,000 Assyrians that are dead, and the rest all flee and retreat. And we'll read about that. I think it's in chapter 39 where that is talked about. So if that's what is in view here, that is indeed what happens. The Assyrians come in with the intention of laying waste to Judea, and end up fleeing in the middle of a siege. Flee and many are killed. He says, and his yoke will be removed from them and his burden removed from their shoulder. So the oppression of the Assyrians will be removed. That enemy will be destroyed. And I take this to be basically a down payment on what has already been said with respect to Babylon. Just as this is what has happened to Assyria, the fate of Babylon is similarly sealed and certain. He goes on to say, this is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. We'll have to keep thinking about this question. Is he talking about the whole earth, or is he talking about something that is more restricted to just the area around Israel? But I'm inclined to think that there are a number of hints throughout here that there is something bigger that's in the back of Isaiah's mind as he goes through these prophecies. In any case, I think we are to understand that just as Assyria will be destroyed, so will all of the nations, that is, the nations who have raised themselves up against God and his purposes. And verse 27, for the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? That when God intends to do something, it happens. And there is nothing that can keep that from happening. God will do what he has planned to do and what he said he will do. Okay, so that is, as I'm understanding it, the conclusion of the oracle that was proclaimed against Babylon. The next oracle is proclaimed against Philistia, starting in verse 28. In the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. And those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security. I will destroy your root with famine, and it will kill off your survivors. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you, for smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. How then will one answer the messengers of the nation, that the Lord has founded Zion, and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it? So this is the second oracle, and this oracle is directed against Philistia. And dating it is a little bit difficult. It says that it happened in the year that King Ahaz died. The king that follows Ahaz is Hezekiah. And we know from elsewhere in Scripture that Hezekiah became king in, let me get the date right, in 727. It says so in 2 Kings 18, 1, 9, and 10. So Hezekiah became king in 727. We also know from 2 Kings 18, 13, that when Sennacherib of Assyria, the king of Assyria, attacked, that was in 701, Hezekiah was in his 14th year. If you do the math, the time of Hezekiah starting his 14-year reign, the beginning of that 14-year period, can't correspond with the time that 2 Kings tells us that Hezekiah began his reign in 727. I suspect that what's happening here is when it says that Hezekiah began his reign in 727, that's when he began his co-reign with his father, Ahaz. That was not an uncommon practice. So if that's the case, Hezekiah then began the co-reign with his father in 727, reigned jointly with his father until 716, at which time presumably his father died, and at which time he became the sole ruler. Then the attack of Sennacherib in 701 would be in Hezekiah's 14th year. So if that's what's being described here, then it places this oracle at the time of 716 is when this oracle is spoken with respect to Philistia. And he starts out by warning Philistia not to rejoice. Presumably, they are rejoicing. And God's word to them is, don't rejoice. And apparently the reason they are rejoicing is because the rod that struck you is broken. In other words, someone who has afflicted Philistia, some king, is dead, or their authority is gone, or they, whoever afflicted them, their power, they are weak. The first candidate would be Ahaz. Did Judah attack and conquer Philistia or a part of it? And from all indications, from what we know in history, the answer is no. In fact, it happened the other way around. That is, Philistia made inroads into the land of Judah. So it's unlikely that Ahaz is what is in mind here. There is, however, trouble in Assyria just prior to this time. Shalmaneser III died in 721. And after his death, Assyria goes through a period of decline, that their power is in decline for a period of time. It's for about a 15-year period of time. And during that time, there are a number of rebellions that the Assyrians have to put down. One is in Babylon, another one is in Syria, And another one is in Urartu, and if I'm not mistaken, that's up in the area near Armenia. So for about 15 years, Assyria is struggling to maintain control over its empire. It's busy elsewhere, and it can't attend to any problems that arise in Palestine. As a result, the Philistines are thrilled because Assyria doesn't seem to be capable of putting pressure on the Philistines to pay tribute and that sort of thing. So apparently what's happening is they are rejoicing because it looks like they can disregard any commitments that they have made with respect to Assyria. But God says, from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. In other words, from this root, in time, there will be another like it. This is not the end. This is just a reprieve, that there will be another like it. A flying serpent's going to come out of it. So there's trouble yet to come. Verse 30, then, is an odd verse. But apparently what it is doing is describing two different fates with respect to the flying serpent when it comes, that is, when the Assyrians come back. There are two different fates. The first one is the first two lines, and the other fate is the last two lines. So the first fate is, and those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security. So that's one possibility. That's one kind of fate that awaits people when the Assyrians come back. The other one is, and it says, I will, God, presumably through the Assyrians, I will destroy your root with famine, and it will kill off your survivors. So that seems to be the other fate. Verse 31 then, God's recommendation to the Philistines is start mourning. Wail, O gate, cry, O city. Melt away, O Philistia, all of you. Why? Because there's trouble coming. For smoke comes from the north, and the smoke is this indication of destruction. And it's coming from the north. That's where the Assyrians would come if they're marching into Philistia. It says, and there is no straggler in his ranks. We've seen that before. That we're talking about a determined opponent. We're talking about an army that is eager and ready to do the destruction. Then the last verse, how then will one answer the messengers of the nation? So what's this talking about? Presumably what it's talking about is now God is addressing the people of Judah. And he's saying, how then will one answer the messengers of the nation? Presumably it's the Philistines sending messengers to Judah. And what messages would they be sending to Judah? It's what we've seen before. They are asking Judah to join them in an alliance against the Assyrians. So presumably that's the scenario. That's what's going on. And the question is, what should Judah say to them? And the answer that God gives is that the Lord has founded Zion, and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it. And it's similar to what the advice that had been given previously. Don't join the alliance. That God is your rock. God is your means of salvation, not an alliance with the surrounding countries. God has founded Zion, and that is where their salvation will come from. That's where their security is. And the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it. Okay. The next oracle is spoken with respect to Moab. We've got two chapters of this oracle. I'll start with the first four verses of chapter 15. The oracle concerning Moab. Surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. Surely in a night, Kir of Moab is devastated and ruined. They have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. In their streets they have girded themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops and in their squares everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. Heshbon and Elealeh are also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. Moab is just east of Palestine, so it's just across the Jordan. And there are two kingdoms on that other side of the Jordan. There's Moab, which is just east of Jerusalem. Then just a little bit further south of that is Edom. Moab is, of all of the neighbors of Israel, Moab would have been the most closely related. Their cultures were closely related. Their languages were very similar. We know that there was a lot of exchange between those two kingdoms. If you'll recall, Ruth, the grandmother, great-grandmother of David, whatever it is, she was a Moabitess. So we know that there was a lot of cultural interaction between Israel and Moab. They, for the most part, they were on friendly relations until later in time, after the time of David. There was conflict that developed with respect to the area just north of Moab, so Bashan, that area, that both Moab and Israel laid claim to that territory. And as a result, there was conflict that developed between those two kingdoms over time. So they did fight. They aren't on entirely friendly terms, but relatively speaking, they're on better terms than most. The oracle starts out saying that surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and ruined. And then that's repeated with respect to Kir of Moab. There has been discovered a statement made by the king of Moab who was bragging about a Moabite conquest of one of the Israeli cities on the east side of the Jordan. And he said, "We conquered it in a night." And it's suspicious that this is in response to that Moab was boasting that they took an Israeli city, an Israelite city, in one night. And now this oracle is saying that surely in a night, Ar of Moab is devastated and Kir of Moab is devastated. Those are two cities in the kingdom of Moab, two important cities. Whatever's happening here, it's sudden. It's sudden and it's devastating. It's hit Ar and it has hit Kir. The people of Moab go up to the temple in Dibon. Dibon seems to have been the religious center of Moab. And the people have gone to the temple, presumably because they're in dire straits and they're seeking help from their God. It also says, even to the high places to weep. The high places were also religious sites. So they're going to seek help from their gods in this time of distress. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. So those are two more cities in Moab. Presumably they have been overrun. Everyone's head is bald and every beard is cut off. Those are both things that you do as a sign of mourning. So presumably then Moab is in mourning over all of the destruction and death that is taking place. In their streets, they have girded themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops and in their squares, everyone is wailing, dissolved in tears. These are also indications of mourning taking place throughout the kingdom of Moab. Heshbon and Elealeh also cry out. Their voice is heard all the way to Jahaz, two more cities within Moab. And Jahaz is, as I recall, is quite a ways to the south. And so these areas also are in mourning over what has happened. The distress is so great that even the army is terrified. It says, therefore, the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles within him. So all of Moab, including its army, is disheartened at what has happened. The next section. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar. And Eglath Shelishiah, for they go up the ascent of Luhith weeping. Surely on the road to Horonaim they raise a cry of distress over their ruin. For the waters of Nimrim are desolate. Surely the grass is withered, the tender grass died out. There is no green thing. Therefore the abundance which they have acquired and stored up, they carry off over the brook of Arabim. For the cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab. Its wail goes as far as Eglaim, and its wailing even to Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon are full of blood. Surely I will bring added woes upon Dimon, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab and upon the remnant of the land. This first line, my heart cries out for Moab, is interesting in that we've got a couple of lines in this oracle with respect to Moab showing empathy on the part of God with respect to Moab. And we don't see that in the other oracles. At least I don't recall that there's any of that in the other oracles. So there seems to be a tender spot in God's heart with respect to Moab that we don't see elsewhere. My heart cries out for Moab. His fugitives are as far as Zoar and Eglath Shelishiah. Those, we don't know where Eglath Shelishiah is, but Zoar is quite a ways to the south. So presumably, the people of Moab have fled this devastation, this destruction, and they have fled to the south. And they're way down east of the Dead Sea, the southern part of the Dead Sea. For they go up the ascent of Luhith weeping, and surely on the road to Horonaim they raise a cry of distress over their ruin. So they're going way down south. For the waters of Nimrim are desolate. So apparently what's happening is as they're fleeing, they're trying to find places to get water and probably to feed their flocks, whatever flocks they're taking with them. And so grass and water become critical as they flee, but they're all fleeing to the same areas. And the waters of Nimrim apparently are being used up. The grass is withered and has died out. There is no green thing. So it's all being eaten up. Therefore, the abundance which they have acquired and stored, they carry off over the brook of Arabim. So the abundance, Moab has prided itself in having an abundance. They have been prosperous, and we'll see later on that there are indications that they've been prosperous. They're trying to maintain what wealth they have as they flee, but that is proving to be difficult. A cry of distress has gone around the territory of Moab. Its wail goes as far as Eglaim, and its wailing even to Beer Elim. So that's throughout the kingdom of Moab, there is this distress as people, as refugees flee. Now, verse 9 is curious. For the waters of Dimon are full of blood. There is no Dimon that is known to us, but the word Dimon is essentially the same word as the word for blood. So it was proposed by Jerome many centuries ago, that this could be a changed name of Dibon that we saw in verse 2. Dibon was the religious center of Moab. And so it's the waters of bloody Dibon that are full of blood. Surely I will bring added woes upon Dibon. So the religious center of Moab is being sorely afflicted with this. And God is intent on making sure that it is afflicted, especially because that was the religious center of Moab. He goes on to say, a lion upon the fugitives of Moab and upon the remnant of the land. So not only do they have to flee this destruction that's coming down from the south, but any fugitives that make it to some semblance of safety from that are prey of the lion. So God is heaping one thing upon another. Okay, next section. Send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the sea, from Selah by the sea of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. Then, like fleeing birds or scattered nestlings, the daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Arnon. Give us advice, make a decision, cast your shadow like night at high noon. Hide the outcasts, do not betray the fugitive. Let the outcasts of Moab stay with you. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer, for the extortioner has come to an end. Destruction has ceased. Oppressors have completely disappeared from the land. A throne will even be established in loving kindness, and a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. Moreover, he will seek justice and be prompt in righteousness. It's hard to piece together exactly what's going on here, but presumably what is happening is in the midst of all this fleeing from the destruction that's coming upon Moab, that there is advice, and the advice is send the tribute lamb to the ruler of the land. So presumably what's being advised is send a tribute lamb to Judah, that the land seems to be the land of God, of Yahweh. Send a tribute lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. So in other words, send a tribute lamb to the temple in Jerusalem. Then like fleeing birds or scattered nestlings, the daughters of Moab will be at the fords of the Arnon. That's a wonderful image if you've ever seen the little baby birds being disturbed from a nest when the mother's not there, kind of running around, not knowing what to do. That seems to be the kind of image here. They're kind of scurrying around just looking for some kind of safety or security, not sure what to do. So in the midst of that kind of environment, what are they being advised to do? Send a tribute lamb to Jerusalem. Then it says, give us advice, make a decision, cast your shadow like night at high noon, hide the outcasts, do not betray the fugitive. So what they're asking for is refuge, what they're asking for is help. They want advice, and here it's more likely that what it means by give us advice is give us a plan, tell us what to do. Cast your shadow like night at high noon. In other words, give us reprieve, give us shelter from the noonday sun. Give us shelter from the elements. Hide the outcasts, do not betray the fugitive. Take us in. We're refugees. We're fleeing. In verse 4, where it says, let the outcasts of Moab stay with you, it actually says, let my outcasts of Moab stay with you, which is curious. And if Kir, the speaker, is God himself, then those would be outcasts that are somehow associated with God himself. Let the outcasts of Moab stay with you. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer, for the extortioner has come to an end. Destruction has ceased. Oppressors have completely disappeared from the land. So there is indeed refuge here for those who are fleeing from Moab. And where is that refuge? That refuge is in Jerusalem. And the extortioner, the oppressors, they are going to be gone. They are to be destroyed, wiped out. Furthermore, in verse 5, a throne will even be established in loving kindness, and the word there is hesed. A throne will even be established in faithfulness to God's promises. And a judge will sit on it in faithfulness in the tent of David. That seems to be in reference to the Messiah. So, a throne will be established just as God had promised. In his loyalty to his promises, he will establish a throne. And a judge, someone who is capable of knowing righteousness and instituting righteousness, will sit on it in faithfulness to God. And it says, in the tent of David, which is curious. Why the tent of David? We've seen elsewhere the house of David is used a number of times in the Old Testament. My guess is that the word tent here is used, underscoring the humble origins from which David came. We saw earlier where the Messiah was referred to as the son of Jesse, and I commented at the time that I suspected that that was there to underscore the humble origins from which the Messiah was to come. So, the judge, and I assume this is talking about the Messiah will sit on this throne, someone from the tent of David, and he will seek justice, and he will be prompt in righteousness. The next few verses. We have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride. Even in his arrogance, pride, and fury, his idle boasts are false. Therefore Moab shall wail, every one of Moab shall wail. You shall moan for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareseth, as those who are utterly stricken. For the fields of Heshbon have withered, the vines of Sibma as well. The lords of the nations have trampled down its choice clusters, which reached as far as Jazer and wandered to the deserts. Its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea. Therefore I will weep bitterly for Jazer and the vine of Sibma. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away, and gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses, for I have made the shouting to cease. Therefore my heart intones like a harp for Moab, and my inward feelings for Kir Hareseth. So it will come about when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself upon his high place, and comes to his sanctuary to pray, that he will not prevail. So now we get an indication of why it is that Moab is being destroyed. And it's for the pride of Moab, its excessive pride, its arrogance, and its fury. Apparently Moab became very prosperous and wealthy and proud of that prosperity. But now, as a result of this destruction that's going to come upon them, everyone shall wail. There will be mourning throughout Moab. And you shall moan for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareseth. And the raisin cakes show up elsewhere. Seems to be a delicacy and a luxury food that people enjoyed, and that's all gone. So the prosperity is all being completely destroyed. Then it goes on to talk about the dismantling of their agriculture and their economy. The fields are all withered, and the vines are withered, and the lords of the nations have trampled those fields down. And it's choice clusters. They had been very prosperous. They had been very healthy vines and productive vines. Now they're all gone. And those fields and those vineyards reached as far as Jazer and even stretched into the deserts. And its tendrils spread themselves out and passed over the sea. And I suspect that's talking about trade ties that went, its economy extended well out into the desert and even into the sea. But that's all gone. And once again, we have a comment, presumably from God, "Therefore, I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibma." So God is there is a tender spot in God's heart for Moab. The shouting that is talking about in verse 9, the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away. This is shouting of joy over the harvests, and those are gone. The only shouting now is of distress and despair as people flee. The gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses, for I have made the shouting to cease. So all of the noises that accompanied the harvest time, all the joy that accompanied the harvest time, that's all gone. That's all been destroyed. The prosperity that Moab had once enjoyed, that's all gone. Once again, verse 11, "Therefore my heart intones like a harp for Moab, and my inward feelings for Kir Hareseth." But this destruction had to happen, and its judgment upon Moab for its arrogance. And God says, "So it will come about when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself upon his high place and comes to his sanctuary to pray, that he will not prevail." All of his requests that he takes to his God, they will be futile. There will be no salvation that will come from the gods of Moab. Okay, last two verses. "This is the word which the Lord spoke earlier concerning Moab. But now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all his great population, and his remnant will be very small and impotent." So presumably this oracle came sometime previous to when this was being written, when Isaiah is being composed as a unit, and it's been incorporated into the book at this particular point in the book, which suggests that this whole section of 10 chapters where we see the oracles, it could be that these oracles came at various times in Isaiah's life, but now as he's composing the book, he puts them all together in these chapters. But, he says, "But now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them." So within 3 years, presumably of when this is written, I'm not sure exactly when the clock starts, but presumably when it is written, that within 3 years, Moab is going to be destroyed. Its population will be whittled down to just a small remnant, and the kingdom as a whole will be a powerless kingdom. And that's 3 years as a hired man would count them, which I probably is by the day, if not by the hour. This is someone who's eager to be done. Okay. This section, what it's saying with respect to Moab, I don't know I can't say for certain that this came to pass as it was described here. As far as I can tell, we don't have the historical records that would allow us to determine such a thing. There, we do know that in 701, the Assyrians did attack, just as they attacked in Israel and Judah. They attacked the area of Moab as well. But we have evidence that Moab decided not to resist Assyria and paid tribute instead. Presumably then they wouldn't have been attacked, but they may have been attacked even though they did pay tribute. But I trust that there was some fulfillment of this that happened within the 3 years, just as it was predicted. I just don't know of any historical corroboration of that. But that shouldn't surprise us. There are a lot of things in history, that, especially ancient history, that we can't corroborate. There's a lot that we don't know. What is the point of this section? And I'm going to talk just in general terms about this whole section of these 10 chapters where it goes through the oracles. And I'll be talking about this more later because there is more to say. But at the very minimum, what's going on in this section is that God is saying the surrounding nations are not going to be able to withstand the devastation that's coming, the invasion and the devastation that is coming. Furthermore, their gods are worthless and will be helpless with respect to providing them security and safety in the face of this destruction that is coming. Therefore, as he said before, don't ally yourselves with these nations. Don't trust them. Don't place your hope in them. And curiously, in every one of these oracles, there is some hint of a hope for security or salvation that is out there. In this one in particular, there's the hope of the salvation that is in Zion. Zion is a place for, and literally it's my outcasts, that there is a place for the refugees of Moab in Zion. Furthermore, there is the promise in this section that the oppression will end. And furthermore, there is a promise in this section that there will be a righteous king in Jerusalem who will reign in righteousness and justice. That's the hope of salvation as it's expressed in this one. And there is a slight hope of, sometimes it's more than a slight hope, but there's a hint of salvation and hope in every one of the oracles as it's expressed. And that hope and salvation is held out to those peoples in those surrounding countries in many instances. So I think what we're getting here is God's reassurance that he will take care of his people. He will take care of Judah. That's where security is. That's the rock. And that's the rock that they have to hold to. They can't turn to any of the surrounding countries for that kind of the help that would provide them any security against this destruction that's coming. All of that will be futile. That God and God alone will be their hope and security. And he will ultimately be the only hope and security, not only for Israel, but all of the surrounding countries as well. We'll be talking about those themes more as we go through these oracles. Okay, questions or comments?
Something I've been noticing as we study the Olivet Discourse on Thursday, and this is really what you read today, is part of the question. Why is it that some prophecy is so specific as to actually mention cities, kings, nations? I mean, without marking a date on the calendar, you really can't get more specific. Mm-hmm. Others seem to be vague, broad and general, and terribly open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. The thing we're running into is that at one point God says, Babylon, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he doesn't say there'll be this powerful people from the general northeasterly, and it'll be really bad, warlike, specific. Mm-hmm. Other times it's, and they will come from the north and wreak great havoc someday. Why? I mean, what are we seeing there?
I don't know the why, but what has been striking to me is, like, if we take this with respect to Moab, if an army is going to attack Moab in this time in history, it's going to come down from the north. East is desert. Egypt is struggling. They are not a world power at this time. So if somebody's going to come, they're going to come from the north in all likelihood. And if an army comes from the north and they're successful sweeping through, it's going to be something like this. So there's a sense all of these cities are going to be affected. So there's a sense in which it's not real, it's not unique stuff. It's not real identifiable kinds of things that you could say with respect to the prophecy. There it was fulfilled. And this event fulfills it because this weird thing happened that was predicted here and it happened. Now, the 3 years, that's very specific. So there are specific things that are put in here. There's without a doubt. What I'm surprised at is how few of those specific, really specific things there are. Things that you can say, that had to have been fulfilled in a certain way, and it was. But why this mixture? And what I'm wrestling with is, it seems to me that the emphasis, the bulk of it, is the more general stuff. The stuff that is hard to say, point to it and say, I know when that was fulfilled. There is some of it interspersed through here, but there's not as much as I would like. And I remember looking, this was several years ago, looking at prophecies with respect to the Messiah and looking for things that are very specific things that were predicted to be true of the Messiah, and was struck at how few there are. There are some, like born in Bethlehem. So there are a half a dozen that you can look at and you say, those are specific, and they were fulfilled in Jesus. But the vast majority are not of that nature. What I'm still struggling with, and we can all struggle along with this, is I'm getting the sense that what Isaiah is painting here is more like an impressionist painting than it is what would be a good example, something that's just picture-perfect.
Pen and ink.
Well, picture-perfect. It's the kind of thing, I remember going to a museum in France and looking at impressionist paintings and was struck by the fact that if you get close enough to them, you can't tell what they are at all. You can't tell what's being depicted. The further you get back, the more that picture emerges, the figures emerge, and you can see what the artist was doing. And I'm sensing that it's that kind of impressionistic painting that we're looking at in this prophecy. And that it's the bigger picture that's going to emerge. That's not to say that there aren't very specific prophecies built into it, predictions built into it. That is true. But they are far fewer than I would have expected, I think. So to answer your question, I don't know.
Could you make a comment about how you sometimes distinguish when it's the voice of God and when it's
Isaiah. Yeah. That's extremely difficult. That's extremely difficult.
There aren't any special code words that you're relying on?
As we go on, we'll find places where in the middle of a statement, the pronoun will change. And it'll be I and he and we, and it changes and doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. In Heschel's book, The Prophets, he said something that I think is worthy of consideration. It's been helpful to me. That what God did with the prophets is he gave them the opportunity to basically experience these things that God was talking about as God himself experienced them. So he's feeling the feelings that God himself was feeling with respect to Moab in this chapter. I find that helpful because that means when Isaiah is speaking, there's a sense in which, when he's speaking these prophecies, there's a sense in which it's irrelevant whether it's God or it's Isaiah speaking, because the two have merged. The two have, they are so consonant that Isaiah can speak for God and he can speak for himself at the same time because it's the same thing. So switching back from one perspective to the other, here I'm speaking third person and here I'm speaking first person, that is Isaiah, it doesn't matter. So that's the best I can do. If you're just going through and keeping track of pronouns, it's just going to drive you crazy. I know, because I've been there.
Is all of these oracles against countries that have attacked Israel at one time, or because I didn't recognize Moab as being one of the attackers like Babylon or Assyria, for example?
Well, there were hostilities between Moab and, mm-hmm. and Israel. The last oracle, I think, is with respect to Tyre. Mm-hmm. And I frankly don't know whether Tyre attacked Israel. I'll have to look that up. But other than that, yes, all of them at one time or another were in conflict with Israel.
I was wondering if it could also be some of their surrounding neighbors that could be possible allies with Israel and or Judah, and God saying, don't even count on your allies. Don't count on your enemies to destroy you, and don't count on your allies to help you. Has that been your observation yet?
I'll need to look at that, but I know that Tyre had been allied with Israel and Judah. Tyre provided the materials to build the temple, for Solomon to build the temple. And they had been on good terms at that point in time. Whether that changed by the time we get to the 700s, I'm not aware of that changing, but it's possible that it changed. But I think what we're to understand here is Judah is isolated. It has no friends. And that's part of their problem, that they are so isolated that where do they turn? They have no place, no natural place to go. And yet they are tempted to ally themselves with countries that they have been in conflict with. And God says, don't do it.
With respect to Babylon's oracle, you said that it had possibly had a long-term fulfillment. Do you see any hint of a long-term fulfillment for this one?
I don't.
In the Messiah, for example.
I don't. With respect to the that section of hope for the future, I think that is long-term. The one right in the middle of the chapter. But with respect to the devastation that's going to be visited upon Moab, I don't see that. There may be a long-term echo of it, but this one, it says specifically it's going to happen in 3 years. Presumably that's what's being described. Whether there's a long-term echo, that's something that we'll have to explore later. One more.
While you were talking about Moab and Tyre, I was just wondering, Nineveh, if I could go that with Jonah, okay. Were they aggressive towards Israel?
During the time of Jonah?
Well, at all, because it seems to be coming out to me, it's not so much, you know, what have you done to Israel? It's what laws God saying that you've done against me. And so I think it's some confusion with that, with Moab and Tyre.
Well, we'll need to talk about that more next week.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. But that question of the attitude of the surrounding peoples to Israel, there's a line in the next section that kind of bumps into that, so we'll have to talk about it. So we'll do that. Okay, thanks.